Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Pat Walsh, and I want to welcome you all, it's such a great crowd, to the Tattered Cover, to your independent bookstore. We appreciate you coming so that we can host extraordinary authors like Michael Wallace this evening. Michael is here with his latest book, David Crockett, The Lion of the West. And he's been nominated for the Pulitzer Prize and is in the Oklahoma Authors Hall of Fame, in addition to hosting American Roads on television. His greatest achievement, according to my granddaughter, who's four, is being the voice of Cars. Yeah, the sheriff in Cars, the movie. So let's welcome him and hear about his latest book and the reissue of several of his others. So let's welcome him this evening.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you. And it's wonderful to come into a city where there's rain. I live in, my wife Suzanne, who's with me, and you'll meet her later. We live at, and have lived for some years in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where there's plenty of water and woods. It's a very green place, but like the rest of this nation, it's been stricken, and temperatures in triple digits for many, many days. And that's the way it's been for us most of the summer, because we're now in the last leg of this national book tour, and we've been all over the country, deep in to the eastern United States on the other side of the Mississippi, where I sometimes go, and all over the Southwest and the West, where I prefer to be. Being a Missourian, a native of Missouri, I've always looked west, down the Santa Fe Trail, down the immigrant trails, down my beloved Route 66, the Mother Road. So this is the part of the country that I do like the best. And when I declared my major, if you will, as a writer, it was about the American West, not just cowboys and Indians, not just the West that many people think about or conjure up when they hear that word, but the contemporary West as well, the pop culture West, the contemporary West. So tonight I'm delighted to be here, as always. I've always had a great experience at Tattered Cover, this location or the other, and I was just saying to someone before the event started, on this particular tour we've had 40 some odd book signings and events, and only one of them has been in a chain bookstore, and I'm very happy about that, very happy. Chains are important to me, but independent bookstores are more important to me. The independent bookstores are like my Route 66. The chain bookstores are like those monotonous turnpikes and interstate highways. I have to take them, but I prefer to be on the old road, the genuine, the authentic, the personal. So tonight I'm in this unusual position of really presenting three books, two of them brand new books, not just Crockett, not just David Crockett from Norton, but also The Wild West 365 from Abrams, another brand new book, and then the reissue, my rascal son right in the center, Pretty Boy, Charles Arthur Floyd. The Pretty Boy book is not brand new. It was originally published many years ago, but unfortunately it's been out of print until now. Until now, meaning my editor, the original editor, Robert Weil, probably, in my opinion, the best nonfiction editor in the country, moved from St. Martin's, my old house, to Norton, a great house, by the way, Norton. And he brought Pretty Boy back. And it's important to me because it was the second of my three Pulitzer Prize nominations. It's a book that definitely needs to be back in print. And it has been optioned as for major motion picture, as has my more recent biography of Billy the Kid, Billy the Kid, The Endless Ride, another Norton title. So I'd be remiss if I wouldn't share with you at least a spoonful from this rascal son, from Charlie Floyd, who hated to be called Pretty Boy. This is really a social history. Where this book ends, Steinbeck's immortal The Grapes of Wrath begins. So you go from nonfiction to fiction. And if you've read The Grapes of Wrath, which I assume you have at least once and are planning to reread, you know that the Joads talk about Charlie Floyd in the book because they came, the fictional Joads, from Salisaw down in Sequoia County, down in Little Dixie in Oklahoma, where Floyd resided. They also, of course, Charlie was also the subject of a wonderful song, The Ballad of Pretty Boy Floyd, written by an Oklahoman that all of you will probably remember from some of his great songs, and I'm talking about Woody Guthrie. And his Ballad of Pretty Boy Floyd, of course, he gave then to Joan Baez and Bob Dylan. There's a great line that fits this book from The Ballad of Pretty Boy Floyd. Some men will rob you with a six-gun and some with a fountain pen. Now, Floyd liked to focus on those fountain pen thieves, on those bankers who were foreclosing on the Joads and others. And he truly was, I came to find, much to my surprise and actually to my glee, he was a sagebrush Robin Hood. Very interesting young man. So let me give you a spoonful, if I can, from Pretty Boy, The Life and Times of Charles Arthur Floyd. And it is the prologue to the book. It's short and a little bittersweet. The Conkle Farm near Clarkson, Ohio, October 22nd, 1934. Alongside every outlaw who survives beyond brief days, hover this nameless legion whom the law does not know or may not touch. Call them his protective angels, if you like. And that's a quote from When the Daltons Rode by Emmett Dalton. Charlie Floyd ran for the trees and the freedom that lay beyond. If he could just get across the field of corn stubble to the tree line, he would be safe. The weeds and the wild grapevines, the honeysuckle and the brambles would grant him yet another reprieve. He would race into the woods and down the slopes, up the steep hills, and across the crumbling masonry of abandoned canal locks filled with water from the recent autumn rain. He was known to some as the Sagebrush Robin Hood, to others as the Phantom Terror, but he was most commonly called Pretty Boy Floyd, public enemy number one. He was invincible, and he always got away. The weather was warm on this October afternoon. Charlie's white shirt and silk underwear were soiled and sweaty, and he needed a shave and bath. His dark blue suit was stained and covered with hundreds of tiny thistles, Spanish needles, which ran the length of his sleeves and trousers. He was a country boy dressed in a city slicker's clothes. A farmer's wife had given him ginger cookies and apples that morning, and he stuffed them in his suit coat pockets. He grasped a .45 pistol in one hand, while his other pistol was tucked in the top of his trousers. Just moments before, he had chatted with Stuart Dyke and his wife Florence. The farm couple had kindly agreed to give him a lift up the road a ways in their automobile, away from the farm owned by Dyke's sister, Ellen Conkle. Charlie had passed an hour with Mrs. Conkle. She had just fed him a hot meal. Inside the farmhouse, she still held the dollar bill the stranger had insisted she take in exchange for the plate of spare ribs. Ellen Conkle watched him wolf down the dinner she had prepared. He sat in a rocking chair on her porch and ate in silence. Afterward, she saw him pacing around, waiting for Stuart and his wife to finish with their corn husking. Charlie fingered the keys in the car's ignition, deciding not to steal the machine. He waited for the farmer to come along. Just before the Dykes walked out of the cornfields, Charlie pulled out his pocket watch. It was almost 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Sunset was about an hour and a half away. He stared at the 50-cent piece attached to the watch fob. Ellen recalled that he smiled when he rubbed some dirt off the cameo ring he wore. No one knows, but perhaps he thought about Ruby or Dempsey or the cotton fields of Oklahoma and the times before he went on the scout. An airplane, an unusual sight in those parts in 1934, droned overhead. Charlie turned his face toward the cloudy sky. The rains of the past few days had disappeared, and even though it was deep in autumn, there were smells of new life in the woods where the maples showed their true colors. Soon killing frost would give way to snow that would enrich the land. Ellen Conkle watched as the stranger climbed into the back seat. Her sister-in-law got up front as Ellen's brother started his automobile. They waved goodbye, and she went back to the kitchen chores. Suddenly, she heard machines driving up to the front of her house and the sound of car doors slamming shut. When she looked out the window again, she saw a band of men in suits carrying guns. They began fanning out over her property. The stranger jumped from her brother's car behind the corn crib and began his run across the field toward the trees. The run only lasted a few seconds. It must have seemed forever to Charlie. Maybe it was like one of those dreams filled with monsters that seemed to last forever in slow motion. Many years later, a federal agent remembered that Charlie ran like an athlete, that he cut and dodged in a broken field sprint. Cookies and apples fell from his pockets and bounced on the ground. Someone yelled for him to halt. Then gunfire erupted, and the bullets bounced up, puffs of dust around his feet. He ran on toward the trees. He gulped in mouthfuls of freedom as he ran. Chester Smith, a policeman from East Liverpool and a sharpshooter who had proudly fought in France and Belgium, knew the man running away was Charlie. There was no doubt in his mind. It was now 4:10. Smith shouldered his .32-20 Winchester rifle. He took aim at the man running in zigzags across the field. When he had Charlie in his sights, Smith wrapped his finger around the trigger. He took a breath and held it. He slowly squeezed. Mr. Floyd. And this, my friends, is my latest son, also a bit of a rascal, although he did not meet his end in an Ohio cornfield, as you all know. This Crockett biography, I must say, I was talking to a friend at dinner tonight, is off to a great start. We have incredibly good reviews from the Wall Street Journal to Texas Monthly. The Texans, I am so pleased, have totally endorsed this book, at least the bright ones, the critics, the scholars, because I'm pretty hard on Texas in this book, as I should be and am. But there are reviews that my late mother could have written, and I'm pleased with that. Now, My first exposure to Mr. Crockett, this inimitable American icon, came, and I, for one, and I bet some of you looking around this room or in that same boat can vividly recall perhaps even the exact date. It was a frosty night for me, December the 15th, 1954, in my hometown of St. Louis. And ABC television had just aired Davy Crockett, Indian Fighter, the first of three episodes produced by Walt Disney for his studio's then new series that had premiered only 2 months earlier. And it was called simply Disneyland, much like the park that would soon appear in Anaheim. And it was called that for quite a while, this anthology series. But there were a variety of other names, including the one that you probably most remember commonly, The Wonderful World of Disney, which would become one of the longest showing primetime programs in American television history. Now, that evening, I myself was 9 years old, but I could have predicted the show's success. I was hooked myself only moments after hearing the theme music. And if you want to hum along, you can. When You Wish Upon a Star, sung by the cartoon insect Jiminy Cricket from the soundtrack of the movie Pinocchio. Longtime Disney announcer, and you'll remember his voice if you think back, Dick Wesson, introduced host Walt Disney, and with some visual assistance from a flittering Tinkerbell, Uncle Walt unleashed this legendary frontier character, Davy Crockett. I was sitting Indian style, right in the middle of my mother's great carpet in the living room, my parents behind me, and all of a sudden, as if like a runaway train, Crockett came crashing out of that 12-inch screen TV of our 1950 table model RCA Victor set. And as they say, I was a goner. With only moments after this larger-than-life Crockett appeared, clad in buckskin and wearing, of course, that coonskin cap, I had been won over. And my fickle 9-year-old heart pounded. Now, I must tell you, that was an incredible year. That past summer, is months before, on two separate occasions, down at Famous and Bar, at the Mother's Store, Famous and Bar, now a long-defunct department retail store in St. Louis, my mother had brought me down to meet some people there on that big parking lot. And there I was, 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and I look up, and it's William Boyd. It's Hopalong Cassidy, standing there with Topper, that fine horse of his. I really thought he was top drawer, Hoppy. You know, he never lost that black hat in a fight. He always kept it on. I just liked him very much. And then it was a 1-2 punch because the next Saturday I go back down again with my mother and there's Duncan Rinaldo standing there, the Cisco Kid with Diablo, with all that beautiful tack and bridles and that great smile, the Cisco Kid. I didn't wash my hands for 2 weeks. But now, on that December night, both of those men were instantly demoted to lower rungs on my list of heroes. Even, I'm here to admit, and I am St. Louis all the way. I bleed St. Louis Cardinal red to this very moment. But even Stan Musial, number 6, swinging Stan the man, the legendary Cardinal outfielder, whose name was literally etched in granite at the top of that hero's list, even the man was in jeopardy of being toppled. So by the time that first episode ended, this image of Crockett, as portrayed by that gangly former Marine from Texas, the 29-year-old Fez Parker, was firmly ensconced in my mind. I didn't even consider staying up for Strike It Rich or I Got a Secret. I forgot about the promise of fresh snow and the good sledding sure to follow. Instead, I made a beeline right back to my room where I pored over the World Book Encyclopedia entry for Crockett, and I dreamed of this swashbuckler with a proclivity for dangerous behavior, which, of course, as a red-blooded American kid, I found to be a most commendable quality. And, as I would later learn, that next morning, out in the snow, when I ran into the Spinks brothers and then my good pal Johnny Hofer, I was not alone. They had all seen it, too. All of you had. More than 40 million people turned into Disneyland that Wednesday night. And by the time the second episode, Davy Crockett Goes to Congress, aired on January 16th, 1955, followed by, on February 23rd, Davy Crockett at the Alamo, I, along with much of the nation, especially the growing ranks of the boomer generation, was swept up in the Crockett frenzy, and we wanted more, and more came, and it came big time in the form of really an unprecedented merchandising whirlwind in which Crockett was commercialized in ways that would have been unthinkable to the man himself, although he would have liked it very much. Every kid, of course, had to have a coonskin cap like Davy's. And almost overnight, the wholesale prices of raccoon pelts soared from 25 cents a pound to $6 a pound, resulting in the sale of at least 10 million furry caps and causing Ike Eisenhower to damn near put those little beasts on the endangered species list. Now, with only months, just a few months of that premiere, more than $100 million, and that's $100 million in 1955 dollars, was shelled out not just for raccoon caps, but for more than 3,000 different Crockett items. And if some of you would step up, I'm sure you'd admit you still have some of these items tucked away, because they include pajamas and lunchboxes. And I know someone back there has some Davy Crockett underpants. Comics, moccasins, toothbrushes, games, clothing, toy rifles, sleds, curtains. It goes on and on. And then there's the song, that catchy theme song, The Ballad of Davy Crockett, and it sold more than 4 million copies. It remained number one on the top 10 list for 13 weeks. And that spring, a warm spring night, May 7th, 1955, there I was back on the floor, sitting Indian style with my great cap on, and out comes on the screen Giselle McKenzie, and she sings the top tune hit of the week on your hit parade. And like every one of my pals, I knew, by God, those words were all true. And, of course, they weren't. But we sang Crockett's ballad at the top of our lungs as we built forts from old Christmas trees and cardboard boxes and transformed the school ground into our own version of Crockett Country. Crockett became our obsession. Now, I realize it's hard for anyone, say, born after 1958, to recall this Crockett frenzy that swept America in the 50s. So profound was Crockett's cultural inundation that no baby boomer can fail to recall this charismatic American hero's name. And this recognition, to my way of thinking, is a good thing. But the veritable flood of misinformation about Crockett's life that resulted, something I became very much aware of later in my life and certainly proved up while researching this book, which in part motivated me to write this book, has created a Crockett mythology that continues to this day. So, my good friends, this is not just another straightforward chronological biography of Davy Crockett, cradle to grave. Nor does it focus just on that one slice from the big Crockett pie, the Alamo. There is much more to Crockett than the last few weeks of his life. And it's not a regurgitation of the many myths, and total lies perpetuated by Crockett over the years. This is a book for people interested in learning the truth, or at least as much as can be uncovered about both the historical and the fictional Crockett, and how the two often became one. And hopefully, readers will gain some new historical insights into the actual man and how he captured the imagination of his generation and later ones as well. So now, a few spoonfuls from Crockett, the Lion of the West. And the first is just a graph or two from my preface. The authentic David Crockett was first and foremost a three-dimensional human being, a person with somewhat exaggerated hopes and well-checked fears, a man who had, as we all do, both good points and bad points. He was somewhat idiosyncratic, possessed of often unusual views, prejudices, and opinions that governed how he chose to live his life. Crockett could be calculating and self-aggrandizing, but also as valiant and indeed as resourceful as anyone who roamed the American frontier. As a man, he was both authentic and contrived. He was wise in the ways of the wilderness and most comfortable when deep in the woods on a hunt. Yet he also could hold his own in the halls of Congress, a fact that distinguished him from so many other frontiersmen. Remarkably, he enjoyed fraternizing with men of power and prestige in the fancy parlors of Philadelphia and New York. Crockett was, like none other, a 19th-century enigma. He fought under Andrew Jackson in the ruinous Indian Wars, only later to become Jackson's bitter foe on the issue of removal of Indian tribes from their homelands. Crockett's contradictions extended beyond politics. He had only a few months of formal education, yet he read Ovid and the Bard. He was neither a buffoon nor a great intellect, but a man who was always evolving on the stage of a nation in its adolescence, a pioneer whose dreams aptly reflected a restless nation with a gaze pointed toward the West. Perhaps more than anyone of his time, David Crockett was arguably our first celebrity hero, inspiring people of his own time as well as a 20th century generation. The man, David Crockett, may have perished on March 6, 1836, in the final assault on the Alamo, but the mythical Davy Crockett, now an integral part of the American psyche, perhaps more so than any other frontiersman, lives powerfully on. In this way, his story then becomes far more than a one-note Walt Disney legend, while his life continues to shed light on the meaning of America's national character. A spoonful from a chapter entitled, Kilt Him a Bar. David Crockett believed in the wind and in the stars. This son of Tennessee could read the sun, the shadows, and the wild clouds full of thunder. He was comfortable amid the thickets and canebrakes, the quagmires, and the mountain balds. He hunted the oak, hickory, maple, and sweetgum forests that had never felt an axe blade. He was familiar with all the smells, the odor of decaying animal flesh, the aroma of the air after a rain, and the pungent smell of the forest. He knew the rivers lined with sycamore, poplar, and willow that breached the mountains through steep-sided gorges with strange-sounding names, many with Indian influences, like the Nolichucky, the French Broad, the Pigeon, the Tellico, the Hiwassee, the South Holston, the Watauga, the Coosa, the Obeys, the Wolf, the Elk, and the Obion. He stalked the dimensions of lakes and streams studded with ancient cypress. He learned that dog days arrive not with the heat of August, but in early July, when the dog star rises and sets with the sun. He carried his compass and maps in his head. He traversed the land when it was lush in the warm times, and when it was covered with the frost, the Cherokees described as clouds frozen on the trees. The wilderness was indeed Crockett's Cathedral. Now I'm going to jump way ahead, sort of towards the end. Crockett lived to be 49 years old. And this is early in the last year of his life. He did become total loggerheads with Jackson, Old Hickory, who the Creeks and Cherokees knew as Sharp a Knife. Crockett had fought under Jackson in the ruinous Creek Wars, so he didn't like what he experienced, the atrocities, the killing, the mayhem, and he vowed never to do that again, although he didn't keep that pledge with those poor black bears. He killed 105 bears in one season. He was a professional hunter of bears, but not of men. And when Jackson, who had no use for any Native American, came up with the Indian Removal Law to take those five tribes on the various trails of tears from their homelands in the southeastern United States to what is now Oklahoma Indian Territory, Crockett stood up against it. The only member of the Tennessee delegation to vote against it, and it cost him his job. Jackson and the others found a candidate to run against him, and they took his seat. As Crockett explained, he was beat by a one-legged man. But he also came up with his famous quote, which he said many, many times, "You all can go to hell, and I'm going to Texas." Now, he didn't go down to Texas out of a fit of some sort of patriotic honor or something for those rascals down there. Anglos had been coming down into the Republic of Texas and settling with permission of the government for some years, starting with Moses Austin. But then they kept coming, and they weren't always abiding by the laws meaning to speak the language Spanish, to join the Mother Church, and eventually not bring slaves. Slavery was abolished in Mexico long before we got around to that. But these gentlemen and ladies, largely Southerners, a lot of land speculators and slave traders, such as Jim and Rezin Bowie, two of the largest slave traders in the country, kept bringing their slaves in. And this is what Crockett faced when he went down there. Crockett had owned a few slaves, but he was not a big landowner, and slavery wasn't a big part of his life or an issue. He wanted to rebuild his life. He was gypsy-footed. He liked to hunt, and he thought he could get back into politics. So he went down there. He found some land he liked. He took his own sweet time. It took him a long time to get down to Texas, and he wasn't there very long. In fact, a lot of people thought he had been killed. There were newspaper stories. Where is the great Crockett? What happened to him? Was he killed? Well, he was chasing bison up on the Red River. He was hunting honey trees. He was talking to friends. He was telling stories. He loved to tell stories. He was having a few horns of whiskey. But finally, he got down there. And this spoonful is from a chapter called Time of the Comet. Finally, in early 1836, Crockett and his original three companions reined up their horses in Nacogdoches, the oldest town in Texas. He was reluctant to leave the good hunting grounds, but he had also heard stories about the successes of Sam Houston, his old Tennessee friend, Stephen Austin, and other land agents or impresarios who had established land agencies and were on their way to becoming wealthy men. Crockett believed that at last he could gain his own fortune and in a place where he could hunt almost every day of the year. As one author noted, Crockett was in a state of euphoria. Throughout Crockett's long ride from Tennessee to Texas, Halley's Comet, the most famous of all the celestial nomads, was clearly visible, just as it is every 76 years or so. Across the land, people were in awe when they spied the object slowly making its way through the night sky. For centuries, people believed a comet appeared as a harbinger of chaos and disaster. Comets were to be feared. One medieval pope even excommunicated Halley's Comet and declared it an instrument of the devil. The appearance of Halley's Comet in 1835, 1836 was blamed for catastrophes around the world, including a horrific fire in New York City that raged for several days and nights, the massacre of 280 people in Africa by Zulu warriors, and wars that erupted across Latin America. The Seminole Indians in Florida saw in the comet's long tail a sign of the tragedy that soon descended on them as they lost their homes and were exiled to Indian territory. Among many Americans, especially Anglo-Texans, Halley's Comet signaled the impending fall of the Alamo. But for the Tejanos, the people of Mexican blood living in Texas, the comet was a portent of the Mexican army's defeat at San Jacinto. Halley's Comet was rediscovered in August 1835, about the time of Crockett's defeat for another term in Congress. It was visible for an extended period and could still be seen long enough for enterprising promoters to issue the Comet Almanac for 1836. It sold well, but not nearly as well as the Davy Crockett Almanac of that year, with a cover illustration of Crockett wading the Mississippi River on a pair of stilts. Stories made the rounds in newspapers and future almanacs claiming that Crockett and his nemesis, Andrew Jackson, had forged a truce, and that Old Hickory had commissioned Crockett to scale the Alleghenies and wring the tail off the comet before it could char the earth. By the time the comet finally vanished in May 1836, not to be seen again until 1910, the ashes of the Alamo, the last battle of Crockett's life, were long cold and scattered. And finally from Crockett, a piece from El Alamo. To those who claim that God made Texas, one may say that figuratively Crockett invented Texas. His blood and the blood of all who died with him transformed the Alamo into an American cultural icon, affecting economic and political conditions in Texas and beyond. The oft-used battle cry, "Remember the Alamo," employed just weeks later by Sam Houston to inspire his force when they captured General Santa Anna and defeated the Mexican army at San Jacinto, still reverberates through history and culture. For many Anglo-Texans and others, those three words conjure images of patriotic heroes, unabashed sacrifice, and love of liberty. The Alamo remains the most instantly recognized battle in American history, with the possible exception of Gettysburg. It has been said that not until the Battle of the Little Bighorn and the death of George Armstrong Custer 40 years after the Alamo would Americans have a more vainglorious event to rally around. Texans also used the Alamo in the revolt against Mexico to establish a republic and later a state that they believed unique and more special than any other. In 1845, when the Republic of Texas gave up its sovereignty to become the biggest state in the Union, it did so with the caveat, depending on whose interpretation of the Texas Constitution is followed, that it could secede at any time and split into five separate entities, thus creating four new states. The strong belief among many Texans was that their independence, their Lone Star status, had been bought and paid for at the Alamo. Crockett's death sums up the single most important aspect of his brief stay in Texas. His contribution to the Lone Star State resulted not so much from how he lived, but how he died. His impact on Texas derives precisely from his death in that battered Spanish mission. In death, he turned into an even more marketable commodity than he had been in life, and the Alamo eventually would become the state's biggest tourist attraction and one of the most popular historic sites in the nation. Crockett's death helped fuel the flames of rebellion against Mexico and also made him a celebrated martyr for the cause. This contributed to the creation of the prideful, sometimes bellicose, stereotypical image of swaggering, boastful Texans bursting with superlatives and pride when describing the land they love. Crockett's demise also helped turn the Alamo into the cradle of Texas liberty and a monument to Anglo-westward expansion that became known as Manifest Destiny. There was the David Crockett of historical fact, and there is the Davy Crockett of our collective imagination. The first was a man who led a most interesting and colorful life. The other is the American myth, featuring Crockett as a symbolic figure with superhuman powers. In this version, Crockett is frequently used by others to promote their own interests. Both Crockett and the Alamo remain ensnared in clouds of myth. In the end, Crockett was a uniquely American character and a formidable hero in his own right. He should not be judged by his death, but rather by his life, including the good, the bad, and the shades of gray. Consider him a legend and a hero, but always bear in mind that he was a man willing to take a risk. That was what he symbolized, and that is how he should be remembered. Mr. Crockett. And last but not least, this other new book. And this book is filled with all kinds of rascal sons and daughters. There are no white hats. There were no black hats. They were all gray hats, as you'll come to find out. I co-authored this with my good wife, Suzanne Fitzgerald Wallace, and we are very pleased to acquire the services of Robert McCubbin, our good pal from down in the hills of Santa Fe, who has my favorite research library, 12,000 books on the American West in that old adobe. Rare books, one-of-a-kind books. It's just intoxicating to go into that library. And hundreds of thousands of images, arguably the biggest private collection of Western photography anywhere. He supplied all the photos for my Billy the Kid book, and 700 of his images grace these pages, many of them never seen before, of all kinds of people. It's about the size of an adobe brick, a little bit smaller. And if you don't like it, which I can't imagine why that would happen, you can always use it as a doorstop. But I will tell you this, don't be intimidated by it. There's old Jim Bowie himself, Bloody Bowie. Because you can open it literally anywhere. What we do here, 365 days, by every date, every day of the year, is something that actually happened on that date. But these entries, the main entries and the photos and illustrations, just move chronologically in the century I chose, 1830 to 1930. So it begins with Crockett and it ends with Pretty Boy through that 100 years. I think it would be good to give you a few spoonfuls from this book, but I would be remiss if I wouldn't summon up to the podium my partner in life, in literature, Suzanne Fitzgerald Wallace, to give you a couple spoonfuls of two of the remarkable women we're going to give you in this tome. Miss Wallace.
Lola Montez. Just after the California Gold Rush peaked, the exotic beauty Lola Montez, no doubt attracted by the abundance of newfound wealth, captivated San Francisco dandies, shocked their prim ladies, and endured the taunts of rowdy miners. Her original name was Marie Dolores Eliza Rosanna Gilbert, but the Irish native adopted the stage sobriquet Lola Montez, became a dancer, and had a series of romantic trysts with Franz Liszt, Victor Hugo, Frederick Chopin, and George Sand. She also served as the confidant and mistress of King Ludwig of Bavaria, a scandalous relationship that contributed to his abdication and also sent the banished Lola packing. During a tour of the United States, Lola arrived in California in 1853 and stayed for 2 years. She quickly became known for performing her famously suggestive Tarantula Dance, a provocative ballet in which Lola pretended to become entangled in a spider's web and discovered spiders hiding in the folds of her flowing gown. As she waved her arms, leaped in the air, and vigorously shook her clothing, revealing her petticoats, the audiences sat spellbound. Lola threw lavish parties, gave dance lessons to Lotta Crabtree, a miner's daughter who went on to become a celebrated star of the American stage, and was frequently seen in the company of her pet Cinnamon Bear. At the dock in 1855, Lola broke into tears as she departed San Francisco bound for Australia. A local newspaper editorial praised her as a noble-hearted and generous lady, whose many good acts so won the esteem of our citizens. Whatever Lola wants, Lola gets. Cynthia Ann Parker. On May 19, 1836, a band of Indians attacked Parker's fort on the fringes of the Comanche frontier in the newly formed Republic of Texas. In the skirmish that followed, five Texans were killed and five others were taken captive, including 9-year-old Cynthia Ann Parker and her younger brother, John. The little girl would become one of the most renowned Indian captives in the history of the West. Both of the Parker children quickly adjusted to the Comanche culture. John became a warrior and took part in several raids, while Cynthia Ann lived as a Comanche for almost 25 years. She eventually married Chief Petanokona and bore him two sons and a daughter. Their firstborn son, Quanah, became the last great war chief of the Comanches. In 1860, Texas Rangers, led by Captain Sol Ross, swept down on a Comanche village, killing many inhabitants and taking others captive, including the long-lost Cynthia Ann and her 2-year-old daughter, Prairie Flower. They were returned to Parker family members, but her many years living with the tribe had changed Cynthia Ann irrevocably. She had nothing in common with her white relatives and begged to be returned to her Indian family. Her escape attempts failed, and when her daughter died of influenza in 1864, Cynthia Ann lost all hope. Broken in spirit and bitter at her enforced captivity, she starved herself to death. It was not until 46 years later that Quanah Parker was able to bring the remains of his beloved mother and his baby sister from Texas to Oklahoma. He dedicated a great feast to honor the memory of his mother, who lived and died as a Comanche.
Lola did inspire that line from Damn Yankees, by the way. I thought you might enjoy this entry, since there's a little bit of cowboy and cowgirl in all of us. It's called Cowboys. And there's two great portraits of these gents right off the trail, probably in Abilene, Texas cowboys, who have been well scrubbed, have a bit of bay rum on them, maybe a little pomade. They've gotten their favorite dish that cowboys always wanted to get that they long for on the trail, either chop suey or some eggs. And they've probably had a tumble or two in the hay and some good, hard whiskey. This is Cowboys. Some historians claim the word cowboy was first used in medieval Ireland to describe boys who tended cattle. Others say the name was bandied about in early America when youngsters such as Daniel Boone and later David Crockett herded cows. Even so, only after the Civil War did the term cowboy come into common use. The heyday of the genuine cowboys was brief. It began in 1865 when Texans returned home after serving the Confederacy, poor in cash, but rich in rangelands teeming with ubiquitous longhorns. Prior to the war, those who had trailed cattle usually were known as drovers. In the early 1860s, Texas ranchers used the term cowboy as they gathered unbranded wild longhorns during roundups, at first called cow hunts. By about 1870, ranchers hired youngsters, whom they generally referred to as cowboys, to herd cattle up the trails to northern railheads and markets. Some of them were only 12 to 16 years old and barely big enough to climb into a saddle. Not everyone approved of such work. Parents, do not allow your boys to load themselves down with Mexican spurs, six-shooters, and pipes, warned a reporter for Texas Denton Monitor. Keep them off the prairies as professional cow hunters. They're in that occupation, who knows, but they may forget that there is a distinction between mine and thine. Send them to school, teach them a trade, or keep them at home. That was written a long time before Willie Nelson. I think just one more spoonful from very near the end of that century that we chronicle. And it's called simply Adios, Wyatt. Wyatt Earp and Josephine Sarah Marcus, a girl from a prominent Jewish family in San Francisco, lived as husband and wife for nearly 50 years. The couple was a classic case of opposite temperaments complementing each other. Earp was quiet and reserved, while his wife was fiery. Still, Josie and Wyatt remained devoted to each other to the end. For Earp, that end came in Los Angeles, just a few minutes past 8 in the morning, on January 13, 1929. The old lawman died quietly. As Josie later wrote in her published recollections, "My darling had breathed his last, dying peacefully, without a struggle, like a baby going to sleep. I don't know how long I continued to hold him in my arms. I wouldn't let him go. He finally had to drag me away. I had gone with him on every trail he had ever taken since those days at Tombstone so long ago." Included among Earp's honorary pallbearers were cowboy movie heroes William S. Hart and Tom Mix. Wyatt's ashes were buried in a Jewish cemetery in Colma, just south of San Francisco. When Josie died in 1944, she was laid to rest with her husband. Cowboys often come to pay their respects. They doff their hats and stand on the manicured grass, surrounded by tombstones, topped with menorahs and stars of David. A world away from the blood and smoke of the OK Corral. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.